Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
This week on Meet and Three, I'm about to go on maternity leave. This is Katie Mosman-Wadler, and before I leave you in the incredibly capable hands of Team HRN, we're rounding out Season 5 with a deep dive into the food rules, weird cravings, and overall hype about eating while pregnant.
There are a lot of safe foods to eat, and we shouldn't be sort of assuming that just because something is raw that it's dangerous.
I just found myself feeling like there was an alien piloting my body and brain, and totally changed the way that I ate.
So was it the eggplant? Sure. Why not? I just don't know.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'll be back soon with our newest and tiniest producer in tow.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people. So I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And our first guest of 2020 is Elizabeth Sandel, who already joined us 7 times on episodes 18, 61, 83, 99, 108, 131, and 156. So you're super regular. And she shared her truly deep insight into traditional Japanese food culture. And Elizabeth is a food writer and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan for over 50 years. And she runs a culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Kitchen and Kibo, Recipes and Stories from Japan's Tohoku, and Kansha, Celebrating Japan's Vegan and Vegetarian Traditions. And today's topic is Japanese kitchen tools. And many unique kitchen utensils have been invented in the long culinary history of Japan, and Elizabeth will introduce us to various kitchen tools and gadgets that make your time in the kitchen more fun and efficient, even if you cook only non-Japanese dishes. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. So, and I have a quick announcement. So I wrote a book about Japanese food, which just came out on December 20th. And so it's called A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine. And the Japanese title is 英語でガイド, 外国人が一番食べたい和食90選. There are 2 titles because it's written in both English and Japanese side by side. And the book is kind of mini encyclopedia of Japanese food. And it covers 90 dishes, sweets, and beverages with fun facts, along with the foundational philosophy and the history of Japanese cuisine. And you can bring the book with you on your trip to Japan, of course, or to your favorite Japanese restaurant as a guidebook. And if you work at a Japanese restaurant, it can be your go-to reference. Also, if you grew up in Japan, the book is useful to explain the basics of Japanese food accurately, which is very hard, to non-Japanese people. Or if you, it can be a fun textbook for both English and Japanese language learners. It is available in bookstores in Japan everywhere and on Amazon Japan, which is amazon.co.jp. And you can order it from Japanese bookstores such as Kinokuniya if you live outside Japan as well. Again, the title is A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine, and in Japanese, 英語でガイド、外国人が一番食べたい和食90選。I hope you'll enjoy reading it. Thank you. So, let's start a conversation with Elizabeth Ando.
Okay, well, I want to read the book first, but...
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me back again. When we sort of tossed around a number of different topics we might talk about, tools immediately came to my mind.
Mm.
Because everybody in the kitchen has to perform certain tasks. Sometimes they really are in a hurry to perform them. Other times they want to make sure that it's the best possible way to do something. And everyone knows about knives and about nabe, different kinds of pots and pans.
Mm-hmm.
But not a whole lot of attention is given to all the little gadgets that really make a difference between being able to get a meal on the table or not.
Yeah, and they are really visually beautiful too, as such traditional, you know, natural tools.
There are many traditional tools, many made of natural materials, and then there are very creative adaptions of those things. Maybe we can start with like tsukemono and making pickles.
Yeah, sure. For listeners, Elizabeth gave me a list of unique Japanese tools, which is amazing. I can't wait to hear all about them. And so probably you can buy everything, even if you're outside Japan, online. And I checked, we are in New York, but...
Right.
I believe there's so many, you know, online Japanese food or...
It's really such a world of difference from even 10 years ago, the availability of foodstuffs and also equipment.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, if you plan to go to Japan, I would suggest go to places like Kappabashi in Tokyo.
Yes.
And Kappabashi is like a heaven for cooks.
Yes.
And they have everything. Yeah.
Decide upon a budget before you go.
Yeah.
because otherwise you'd be in trouble. And there are a couple of other places as well that have just an array of kitchen gadgets.
Right. But also, local towns and cities, they have definitely specialized shops, which is very reasonably priced.
Always. It's a great temptation. So really, you have to sort of stay focused. But also open to new ideas when you see things in the store.
Yeah, and it's just fun to see. Even if you don't cook, you feel
right.
But let's talk about tasks in the kitchen and how different tools were developed to perform those tasks in the context of Japanese cuisine.
Okay. There are sort of two sets of circumstances that have almost always existed in Japan, not unique to Japan, there are other food cultures. One is needing to conserve fuel. There's relatively little fuel available for cooking in Japan, and wanting to use it most efficiently.
Mm.
And the other is space. Very little space. I know that, you know, people here in New York who have small apartment kitchens complain, they're bigger than most Japanese home kitchens in Tokyo, certainly. The average is a single burner, maybe a double. I have three, which is considered sort of just amazing. The average in New York is four, is it not?
Yeah, I feel like I'm a rich person.
It really changes your approach to putting a meal on the table. And it forces you to multitask, to do many things at one time. You've got little space in which to move, so several things have to happen at the same time. But it also urges you to come up with the cleverest, most effective way of performing any given task. And one of the food categories in Japan that has deep history and is currently still part of almost every meal are tsukemono or pickles. And some of them are very time-consuming and require months, if not years, to maturity. But there are a whole bunch of what I call impatient pickles, the quick pickles that can be made in maybe 10 minutes, maybe 2 hours. And in order to encourage the fermentation or the beginning of fermentation, the change in the vegetable, primarily in vegetables, you need to apply pressure and weight. And I don't know how many other food cultures have to come up with weights that work in the kitchen.
Right. So the weight basically breaks down the structure
right.
and the cells of whatever the vegetables are, and then make it easier to ferment, like the bacteria easier
right.
to...
So typically it's either a brine that has primarily salt, mm-hmm. or maybe a koji, shio koji, that's there. And until the fibers of, let's say, a haksai cabbage or a cucumber are somewhat smashed or broken or bruised, there's no room for those flavors to get in there and start working. So most skemono are best made in large quantity in huge tubs with stones on top of them, but that's not quite practical for an urban kitchen.
Right. Or I don't want to carry each time.
No, nobody wants to do that. Although you can still, in almost every homeware store in Japan, find 1 kilo, 5 kilo, and 10 kilo weights that are for sale. They're no longer stones, but they're actually weights that people will use if they're making a lot. But a very clever gadget, an instrument, was developed called a tsukemono ki. It's a shoktaku tsukemono ki, meaning you can put it on the table. It'll also fit in the refrigerator. I've usually referred to it as a pickle press. Mm-hmm. It looks somewhat like a press, and depending upon which gadget you buy, it's got a screw top that you can adjust the amount of weight. The idea is to massage, if you will, or have salt or koji is the most common, interact with the vegetable, and then put pressure on top of it and wait until the liquid rises.
Right. Because something starts fermenting, it produces CO2, so it gets bubbly, and then to avoid bacterial contamination, you have to put the vegetable, keep it submerged, so the weight and the pressure works to keep it clean.
And it needed to be clean, which is why stones are more challenging.
Right.
And this little gadget, it can be as small as something you hold in your hand, something as long as perhaps, I'm bad on inches nowadays, what's this, about 6 or 7 inches long? It's about 15 centimeters is the average size of the machine, the gadget that you're going to be able to buy here in the States. And it works very, very well. Within 20 minutes, 30 minutes.
Wow.
Or if you, in the morning before you leave for work, you sort of put together a little something, you come back and you've got a wonderful...
Right, it's not too expensive either.
No, it really isn't. For those who... they come only in plastic, and the plastic doesn't survive a whole long time when it comes to the corrosive action of things like salt and koji. So what I do is I put them in a resealable plastic bag. And massage them in that, put them in the bag, in the actual box, and then screw on the top on top.
So that way you can maintain outside plastic longer.
It will last longer. I do it almost every day, or at least certainly 4 or 5 times a week, and I'm still using the same machine I did about 3 years ago.
Great. So. Yeah, I think globally people started to ferment things.
Yes.
And pickles are really popular now.
They are. And here you can control it because you can see it. You can change the amount of pressure by screwing it tighter or looser. If necessary, you can pour off some of the extra liquid. So it's very easy to manage in one of these little gadgets.
Wow.
And that was not true when you had a huge tub with, you know, 10 kilo of...
I am convinced. I look for it today.
Yes.
And go home and it's a search.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
Like a mutual trading. Or some of those other, you know, Korean, those places actually sell online and I found them. Many things, so...
Right.
All right, okay. So what's next? That's, I think, oroshiki was one of the interesting things.
Well, lots of cuisines. Great.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different kinds of abrasive surfaces that things get grated against. Mm-hmm. The classic in Japan looks almost like a bunch of metal thorns.
Right.
And it has a little well at the bottom, mm-hmm. and can be used for things like ginger or daikon, a small piece of daikon. But that's a classic sort of all-purpose.
Right. So that's called the orosu means grate. So right. Oroshi gane. Gane right. is like a metal.
Is the metal part. Right. And two problems, if you will, with that. One is metal often interacts with certain vegetables mm-hmm. or certain condiments and adds a less than wonderful flavor to it. And so, indeed, ceramic ones were created because they don't transfer flavors mm-hmm. and they also don't stain the way that sometimes the metal ones will. And different shapes. So either you're holding it upright and going up and down. Some of the ceramic ones actually look like a dish.
Right.
And you're taking the daikon or the ginger and you're drawing circles with it. There's several different dishes in which daikon is best not finely grated, but very coarsely grated, almost like chunks. And for that, there's something called an oni oroshi.
Okay.
And an oni is a monster, and it looks somewhat like a monster, if you will. It looks actually like, I don't know that anyone who's listening remembers actually seeing one of these washboards for doing laundry, made out of wood, and you would rub clothes up against it in order to get release dirt and to get spots out. But it's a very rough textured, it stands on an angle, and you take the daikon in one hand and the oni oroshi in the other, and you actually just rub it up against it,
right.
and shards of daikon come out. It's particularly wonderful on soba, on cold soba. And then you would just add maybe a bit of the usual kind of soba sauce that's used, the flavored soy sauce with it. It's also wonderful in a kind of nabe. Sometimes it's called yuki nabe, where snow in there, and you would do two different kinds of oroshi daikon. One that's very fine, that looks almost like slush, and the other these huge chunks and chards. And the difference in texture makes a wonderful contrast when you're eating it.
And also the level of spiciness, too, depends on...
Very much so. And with the large oni oroshi, you're able to use almost the whole daikon at one time. So you're getting all of the flavors from the tip to the neck at the same time, rather than just a piece of the daikon at any one time for that.
So it's oni oroshi, O-N-I-O-R-O-S-H-I. Okay. Right. And let's talk about shark skin.
Yes. Also, same. I don't know whoever first thought to take a wasabi root and rub it up against a shark's skin, but it obviously was a great idea because it preserves the aroma and the fire of the wasabi without all of the nasty sort of fiber that sometimes gets left behind. And also wasabi, a fresh wasabi root on a metal grater is not a wonderful taste combination. It really does begin to go off and go very, very bitter. But I don't know who thought of it.
I read something I forgot. That was like, it was not the main intention to make something wasabi.
Not.
It's like we used from something else.
It could be. Shark skin is used, or has been used in Japan, for a number of things as a non-slip surface. In the old samurai, in their swords, when they pull them out, so that their hands don't slip, even if they're...
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, it's very important, especially if they're sweaty and sort of nervous, and the fact that it would not slip. But on several surfaces in Japan from a long time ago, same... Okawa has been used.
Interesting. Yeah. So I looked up, and then so wasabi needs to be finely ground to produce the spiciness, that the unique spiciness, and the fine surface of shark skin is ideal for that, because it's that kind of like fine, you know, dots Yes. On the surface, aerates wasabi, which makes the texture creamier and the flavor sweeter.
It's incredible. The difference is night and day. If you're going to spend the money and the time to source a fresh wasabi, absolutely, you need one of these graters.
Right.
You don't want to grate it on anything but...
I can't agree more.
Yeah,
and it's not too expensive either.
No, it isn't, and they come in various sizes, and I would encourage the larger size. Sometimes people will say, oh, well, I'm only using it once in a while, I'll buy the smaller one. The larger one allows you to make circling motions as you're grating it. It gives you more space.
Right. And more aeration, I guess.
More aeration and really creamy, sweet, delicious with fire.
Mm.
Yeah, wonderful.
I wonder how you can apply other kind of, you know, flavoring stuff, like... ginger? I don't know. Garlic?
I have tried ginger on it. Garlic works well. So do shallots, which normally defy grating well. In other words, it usually falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
What else have I tried with it? Nutmeg, which is entirely different.
Wow.
Yeah. And you need something to help, you need a brush to help get it off afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite extraordinary. There's nothing... quite like that texture. I think when they first made the ceramic graters, they were intending to mimic that with the ceramics, but it is different.
Interesting. Yeah. So, and it looks cool. Like usually it's a wooden back and then it's white, beautiful shark skin.
Yeah, it's kakui.
All right, so next one is suribachi and surikogi.
All sorts of food cultures mash in a mortar with a pestle. The suribachi is the mortar and the surikogi is the pestle.
Mm.
What's different about the Japanese is that it has texture and that the traditional ones were ceramic. They were earthenware. Mm. So the earthenware is both good and has challenges, meaning that it will stain and it will also absorb odor.
Mm.
And I have a dedicated suribachi for just sesame.
Oh, okay.
Because it's really almost impossible to get the oils in the sesame also really begin to permeate the bowl.
Mm.
And it's almost impossible to get rid of that aroma. If you want that nutty, wonderful aroma, it's terrific to do other things in there, but otherwise not. And with the advent of food processors, and the Japanese really took to the mini food processors quite quickly, I'm going to say about 20 years ago maybe, because before that, in order to make the equivalent of a pâté or that texture in a suribachi took hours.
Like a whipping
great cream. Great determination. As a matter of fact, one of the dishes in shōjin ryōri, and shōjin really means earnest effort. It's also vegetarian or vegan, but means earnest effort. And one of the things that demonstrated earnest effort was making goma tofu.
Right.
And it takes about two and a half hours. Mm. Nobody would have upper arm flab if they did it regularly.
Yeah. Shōjin means a spiritual training.
It really is, and making this in the suribachi is spiritual. It's also sort of fun, I think, in the modern kitchen because somebody typically needs to hold the bowl and somebody else is doing the grinding.
Yeah.
In the old days, I can remember the first kitchen in which I did anything with the suribachi was the old kitchen in Shikoku. And there was a hashira, a pillar, that I would angle the bowl up against and then kneel so that it was between my knees. And I didn't need somebody else to hold it for me. But it's always nice to have and to switch off back and forth.
And again, the suribachi, well, basically it's ceramic, but the inside is like a kind of combed texture, like fine comb texture.
Right.
And it's kind of also spirals in it. So it's
so it goes in different directions, which means that you get much more power. Again, this notion that you have you're wanting to make the tools the most effective, efficient possible. trying to grind something against a smooth surface, it takes a whole lot more time and energy, and it's not going to become as smooth as if you had this. It's almost like a, if you look at it like a serrated knife, but it's on a flat surface. Right. Yes, it does look like combs at odd angles to each other.
Yeah, I don't know who invented that pattern, but it's like a jagged groups, like,
well,
amazing.
When you're making pottery, there's a stage at which I think it's referred to as leather hard, where you can still make an indent in it, but it won't change shape. And that's when indeed the suribachi, and there is a comb that's used, a kushi, that's used to make it, if you see people making suribachi, and then they fire it so that it stays that way.
Right. And the surikoge, that's wooden.
The pestle,
is wooden to protect the ceramic. So.
And the classic traditional was actually a branch from the sancho, the pepper plant tree.
Right.
And ever so slightly you might get a spicy aroma when you first started it. The surikogi that I have 50 years later is probably about 2 inches shorter. So at some point, it does, I guess it does get used up.
But 50 years, still 20 inches.
But it's still usable. And there's nothing quite like a suribachi, the texture that you would get. And for something like sesame, you can control between semi-cracked, fully cracked, mashed, a little bit of oil coming out so it gets creamy, to really making the equivalent of tahini.
Right.
And that's what the shojin is all about, making the equivalent of tahini.
Actually, the size can be from very small to medium to big. And then I don't like food processor because I have to clean up later. Right. But for quick sesame, something very, you know, small one works very well.
Like indeed. The food processor is better for things like meat and fish and certain very fibrous vegetables. But otherwise, a suribachi, I find, is it's also easier. It's interesting that there are special little brushes that come to get the ground sesame out of the grooves that are in there. And they're the same as regular brooms. Hoki that are used to sweep the floor, but they're very little, and they're used to sweep out the inside of a suribachi.
That's one of the cute
items. They're very cute.
Right. Okay. And so, next. Oh, but by the way, suribachi, it's S-U-R-I-B-A-C-H-I. And the surikogi, that's the, you know, pestle, that's the S-U-R-I-K-O-G-I.
Right.
So suribachi and surikogi.
Because suru means to grind.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, so the next one is otoshibuta. I think it's really cool.
Yes. I often, when I'm giving a slide lecture, will show a slide that comes from a 16th century kitchen, and they're using otoshibuta, and it wasn't new then.
Wow.
So it's got long, deep history in terms of actually being used. And what's interesting about an otoshibuta, and that's what the name means, otosu means to drop into, and futa or buta is a lid, it doesn't sit on the rim of a pot the way most lids do, but it sits on the food instead.
Mm.
And because it sits on the food, you can simmer with very little liquid, it doesn't dry out, and the space between, usually, again, in centimeters, it's easier. The lids come usually in 14, 15, 16, 18, 20, and 22 size, centimeter size lids. And they're intended to be used with skillets or pots that are about 2 centimeters larger.
Mm.
So that, in effect, you have about 1 centimeter, which is about a half an inch maybe, around and a parameter around, so there's enough room for evaporation to take place. You can intensify the simmering liquid.
So it doesn't go break into a volume boil.
No.
And also, because it's evenly always covering the surface.
And as the liquid begins to sort of bubble, it hits the lid and gets forced back down. Mm. So if you've got something like a whole fish, which you don't want to have to flip back and forth because it's going to fall back, you don't have to because it's going to get evenly cooked. It's almost a circular motion as it gets reintroduced to it.
So the heat distribution as well as the flavor distribution, because it's always consistent.
And they're made of wood. The traditional ones are made of wood. And because they're made of wood, and they're flat on the bottom, so they sit directly on top of the food. And because they're made of wood, they don't stick. They don't get hot.
Right.
The other advantage of using the wooden lids is aku, or all that scum or froth that sometimes develops, comes right on top of the lid. There's a handle, a piece down the center. I've just updated my website, and there's a new post about otoshibuta. So everybody should go take a look at that.
And you have pictures. Recipes.
Right, and I've got recipes there as well. But there's a handle in the center, and all of that gook sticks to the handle, so when you lift it up, you don't have to skim the liquid.
How genius is
that? It really is. It's completely genius, and lots of people who have cooked with otoshibuta in a Japanese kitchen then apply that to all sorts of other cuisines that they're making.
Yeah.
The other genius thing that an otoshibuta can do is act almost as a press to sear something. So when you're simmering in liquid, it's terrific because it helps the flavors and the color to circulate and to intensify and not dry out.
Mm.
But when you're doing something in a dry skillet, let's say you're cooking fish, and when you flip it over, the muscles in the back of the fish tighten up, and that's what makes it curl, and you want to keep it flat. So you put the otoshibuta on top, just as you're turning it, and hold it down for a few seconds just to make sure that the skin will have complete contact with the skillet. And I think on the website I did one with mushrooms. Also, there's a way of searing with mushrooms that works very well with an otoshibuta.
Just a little wooden lid, but it does multiple things.
It really does. It's one of those wonderful. And my otoshibuta I have a collection, and the newest is about 10 years old.
Mm.
But the oldest was given to me by my mother-in-law.
Wow.
And so long before I even came to Japan.
Right. And it's not too expensive either, again.
No.
Right.
So
it's otoshibuta, otoshibuta, otoshibuta.
Right.
Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss more Japanese kitchen tools, including amazing gadgets to make elaborate Japanese bento boxes. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com. Did you find? Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs, broadcast live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Elizabeth Ando, a food writer and cookbook author and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So now let's talk about Japanese-style bento boxes, which is becoming popular globally.
Really?
And especially character bento is a cultural phenomenon, and character bento, or karaben, is a bento box elaborately arranged to feature neat anime characters or other cute figures such as animals. And if you Google caravan, it's amazing how cute they are.
Especially if you go to Instagram or to Pinterest or any of the others that really feature photos. It's incredible.
And I think I heard it initially it started as like mothers tried to make your kids eat lunch, but it's way beyond that.
Way beyond that at this point. I think it's all about a message to your food. And it was a message from mother to child showing caring and interest. Several years ago, I'm going blank now on the name of the book, there was a book all about a high school student whose mother had made her lunches and actually sent messages with each of them.
Wow.
Cut out of nori. So one of the gadgets that you'll find, and I have seen them here in some of the Asian food stores in New York as well, are these punch holes for nori to make different sort of shapes. And especially smiley faces or cute little pandas. It presumes that you already think of rice as something you can shape and mold. You can also keep it plain and flat inside your bento box and then draw pictures on top of it. But many of the karabeng are based on some kind of rice that has been molded into a shape, perhaps Hello Kitty, perhaps
Panda, whatever.
In other words, there are rice molds that are specifically sold to make them look like these characters.
Right. Why don't we get up just only, you know, the triangle one? And that was like genius at the time, but that's now crazy.
No, these are serious. And there are kits that are sold in Japan. I thought I saw one or two of them here in New York as well, where you're going to get the mold. It's typically made out of plastic. Alert, though, you should not put that plastic in the dishwasher. Japan, homes in Japan don't really have dishwashers that have that kind of... It's not the hot water that hurts. It's the heating unit that dries them off afterwards, and they'll warp. So those should be probably hand-washed. But typically, the kits will come with a mold for the rice, a punch stencil for nori and or thin egg omelets. Because if you make them paper thin, you can also cut them into all different kinds
of
shapes.
That means your mothers have to be able to make thin eggs.
Eggs, right? And different kinds of stencils that you put on top and then would, instead of cocoa powder, it would be maybe yukari, which is made out of red
shiso.
Or aonori, which is green. I'm trying to think of other things. People who have purchased already made ochazuke kinds of packets know those different colored flakes and things that can be sprinkled on top. And if you sprinkle them on top of a stencil and you lift the stencil up, you have your message, you have your character. So often these kits will have a combination of punches, stencils, and molds, and show you how to create all of these very elaborate, kawaii
items.
The really, really cute stuff.
Yeah, it's tempting. I feel like buying the kit and make for whatever for no reason.
I know I know many more grown-ups who do it than kids. I think in Japan also it was originally an obvious way, a measurable way, to see that the mother was caring for the child. And especially since the kids would take them to school, the teacher would see it, all of the other kids, both good and bad, competitive, very competitive.
That's crazy. How stressful it can be for...
Very. And when blogging first started... The number of home bento blogs got a little out of hand. but I think they're still up there. So if you Google even in English, KYR, you'll get some very interesting pictures.
Yeah, it's the worst seeing. It's just like a catalog of cute things.
Yes, yes.
Right. Okay, so let's see. I would like to talk about like Saibashi.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I was not particularly skilled in using chopsticks before going to Japan. I don't recall having difficulty learning to use them. What I do remember most was my first visit back to America and getting an olive out of an olive jar with saibashi.
Mm. So saibashi basically is a long, long
chopsticks. And saying, how did I live without these two long sticks before? I mean, how does anybody live without saibashi?
Wow.
They're such useful sticks, including one long one if something gets stuck and you have to tap it from a high shelf. It's useful. But the notion that you can you can grab hold of and pull out, up, around, turn around, and depending upon how your wrist holds the chopsticks, you've got so many options for manipulating.
Right, and so, like, for instance, in Japan, usually people have tempura, you know, deep frying pot, which is dangerous and long.
The longer the better.
Yeah, and then I think if you go to Japanese restaurants or Chinese restaurant, people use chopsticks nowadays like very well.
Right.
So it's not a challenging thing, I think. And it's like if once you have the saibashi, it's so much safer and so
It's safer,
easy.
So it's so much easier. Scrambled eggs. I couldn't imagine making scrambled eggs without saibashi. And again, the single one gets used for lifting if you're making your thin omelets. Mm-hmm. So you can trace around the side of the pan and then lift the omelet up and flip it over with a single chopstick. Incredible. Once you try it out, I can't imagine anybody turning back.
I can't agree more. Okay, so I want to also talk about knife sharpener. So Japan is very obsessive about knife, Japanese knife, of course, and sharpener. I happened to get one recommended by professional, like really high-end knife producers. And I can't with it without it because it's easy to sharpen.
Right.
And
Is it something that you, like a flat surface on which you
serious stone, like coarse side and the other side is finer.
Right. I also did not ever think about sharpening knives before I went to Japan. So I first learned in Japan, and I learned on a stone, and the stone had two different surfaces, depending upon which side you turned up or down. And being able to control the amount of pressure that you exert, I got sort of spoiled. And when somebody gave me a knife sharpener, where you insert the blade and you pull it, it just felt all wrong.
And it damages the knives.
I would think so. I also, it must admit, I don't know how to use a steel.
I can't stand the sound, so that's like, you know, off limits.
Well, also the sound is pretty unpleasant. But I don't see how that does what it needs to do, which is to resurface the cutting edge, and the ability to have control over the angle and the degree of sharpness is what I like most about a stone.
Right. Yeah, because like kitchen sharpeners, like, you know, plastic, and it looks safe, but it doesn't work for a long time. It's worn out. And I was not good at using the stones first, but now it's kind of your body remembers.
It does.
And you can use your body. You don't need any heavy, you know.
It doesn't require a whole lot of strength, no.
Right.
What I find is very important in my kitchen, especially in Tokyo, is that I have something so that it goes up against a wall. It doesn't move. So I have a cutting board that I use wrap a towel around it because it does get a little messy. You have to wet the stone, and as you're sharpening it, a lot of the sort of brown, gray color comes off. So I have a dedicated board and a cloth that I wrap around it so that when I lean forward, the stone doesn't move.
Right.
And I can then not... I don't have to exert a lot of pressure. It's very light pressure.
I have a very abbreviated version of it. So I have like, you know, the kitchen cloth.
Right.
I just like wet kitchen towel.
Right.
And I put the stone. It never doesn't go anywhere.
Well, your counter must be better than the one I have in Tokyo.
Yeah, well, it's just a New York City regular apartment, but that's my trick. So far, it's very safe. So.
Right.
Yeah.
My surface is, for better or for worse, very smooth.
Oh.
And it really slips if I don't do that.
A very old apartment, so.
Everybody, you should figure out your own setup.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So now we would like to discuss your new website. You updated your website. So you have very, very informative website. So do you want to tell us that?
Okay. I had... avoided the nuisance of really rethinking my website for several years. And with everybody using different kinds of phones, pads, it had to be responsive. And as long as I had to recreate the website to make it really responsive, I decided to step back and really redesign what I wanted to do.
Mm.
And what I wanted to do was be able to continually archive and have people who come to the website access that archive. I couldn't do that with my previous website. Once I had posted something and I replaced it, it was gone for viewers of the website. Right. I still had access to it in the back office, but I couldn't make that available
to
other people.
Well, in the past, some listeners requested for, you know, some recipes, but it's not there anymore. So that was...
Right. But all the old links are now not going to work because it's a new site.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did was I took the information I had about the amount of time that people, a number of people who stopped at any particular page and how long they spent on it, and took the top 30, redid them, and post-dated them. So if you go to my website now, you'll see things from... June of 2019, three times a month, on the 2nd, the 12th, and the 22nd. When I first went to Japan, stores did not have a day of the week that they were off. This was in the 60s. They had 3 days a month.
Okay.
And sometimes it was 2, 12, 22. Sometimes it was 7, 17, 27. And I decided which set do I want to go for, and the 2/12/22 I decided was an easier number for me to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So every month I'll be posting three things, and yesterday I updated and put the piece about the Otoshi Buta up there. The other great thing about that kitchen culture page is you can sign on, ask questions, leave comments.
Mm.
So we can have a conversation about it, and that wasn't possible before either.
Well, you really are the expert.
Well, I have a lot of experience that I want to share with people, but what I've found over the years is I also need to be responsive. I need people asking. I have lots of things, interesting things that I can share with people, but then I want people to respond, and I want to be able to respond back to them.
Right.
And this website will allow me to do that. Also, like this podcast, I'm going to... I hope I can get the code right to get it back up later this afternoon. So on the books and media page, I have a lot of the... I have all the podcasts that we've done and also some of the video things that I've done.
Great.
That are available for people.
Mm.
So it's a constantly evolving... Also about programs. If anybody's coming to Japan, by all means, sign up for a program.
So it's like the class... room setting.
Right. So what I wanted the website to do is be inviting to people who were just curious and then hook them to keep coming back and engage in conversation.
Right. And I think your information is very unique in the sense that, you know, you read user's mind because that's the problem you went through
right.
and you conquered. So
I learned along the way, many years, lots of experience, and I'm very eager to share it with everyone.
It's great. So the website's address is
tasteofculture.com, www.tasteofculture.com.
Great. Well, you must be feeling really like achievement.
I am. It's a lot of work. I really am. And for a short while last year, I got locked out of Facebook, and it was really very difficult because there was no platform for me to be able to communicate with people. Back on Facebook again, too.
Even if you didn't do anything, Facebook decided to.
Just for whatever. glad to be back. And I see both the website and social media as sort of complementing each other. So one doesn't replace the other. They sort of complement each other. And I've just started Twitter, don't really get it. So if people want to educate me about the best way to use Twitter, that's okay too.
Mr. Trump. He will be a teacher.
No, thank you. Not that way.
Yeah. Okay, so hopefully you're going to come back sometime again this year?
Not sure exactly when. The Olympics are coming to Japan in the summer and haven't made a final decision yet about what to do about programs that would be feasible and inviting to visitors who will be coming to Japan. So I'll have to work around that. And once I have that sort of set, I'll know what my schedule is.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, if you go to Japan, why not? Just learn about Japanese food from cooking side as well. So
there are lots of people who come to Japan, and food is a way, and I'm delighted, food is a way of getting into the culture and exploring. Right. So.
Exactly. So.
Good.
All right. Thank you. So thank you again for joining me. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests, show guests, or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikokatayama.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.